So, when we think of terrorist financing, we usually picture like shadowy offshore accounts or, I don't know, briefcases of dirty cash in dimly lit parking garages.
Right, yeah, it's very cinematic. But the reality is usually much more mundane.
Exactly. And welcome to this deep dive, by the way. Today, we are looking at a stack of incredibly detailed sources that break down a landmark French court case regarding the PKK, that's the Kurdistan Workers' Party.
Yeah, and the mission for our deep dive today is to really decode how perfectly legal money, everyday cash, transforms into prohibited financial support.
It is wild to see how this happens. We're going to see why standard banking controls completely miss this and how seemingly ordinary community structures, like the places you walk past every single day, become actual geopolitical battlegrounds.
Because this source material reveals that it happens right in plain sight, at local restaurants, community centers, and through like very small, totally everyday cash withdrawals.
Yeah, it connects right to your daily life. But the way this specific investigation started is just, it blows my mind because they weren't looking for money at all.
No, not at all. It started with a totally different kind of crisis.
Right. So in 2020, two young Kurdish women, aged just 18 and 19, went missing in southeastern
Which
France.
is terrifying for any family. And initially, authorities treated it as a standard missing persons case.
But they discovered these teenagers actually traveled across Europe to join PKK training camps.
Yeah, and tracking that recruitment trail is what blew this wide open. It led investigators straight into this massive, highly organized financial structure.
Okay, let's unpack this because it's like pulling a loose thread on a sweater, right? The authorities think they are just looking for a missing person, and suddenly they unravel this massive invisible network raising an estimated 2 million euros a year.
Right out of a local Marseille association, yeah. And it culminated in that April 2023 Paris court case, which convicted 11 Turkish Kurdish defendants.
Handing down sentences of up to 5 years, I think some of them were suspended, but still a major bust.
Oh, absolutely. And what's fascinating here is the absolute link between recruitment and finance. I mean, an organization needs more than just money.
They need people.
Exactly. They need accommodation, transport, logistics, and recruits. So the recruitment networks and the financial networks, they fundamentally reinforce one another. The same structure that moves a person can move the money.
Which brings us to how they actually raised 2 million euros a year without, setting off bank alarms, because they weren't just asking nicely. The sources talk about this concept called the campagna.
The campagna, yeah. It translates to a revolutionary tax. And this is collected from Kurdish individuals and businesses.
But it is not voluntary at all.
Not even a little bit. The collecting organization literally dictates the amount. They base it on a person's salary or a business's turnover.
Even just visible property ownership. Like, oh, you own a nice house, you owe us this much.
Precisely. They do the math for you.
But I have to push back here. If a local restaurant owner just goes to the bank, hands over some cash to an organizer, how can any investigator tell if it's a voluntary donation or extortion?
Well, that's the core issue.
Because on paper, it just looks like a completely normal business withdrawal, right?
It does. And this is exactly why banks alone can't see the crime. They see the withdrawal on a screen. They do not see the person waiting outside to collect it.
Right.
And they don't see the immense, heavy social pressure surrounding that transaction because there are no direct physical threats needed.
Oh, wow. So they don't even have to threaten violence.
Usually, no. The coercion relies heavily on the threat of community exclusion, being labeled disloyal, or facing total social isolation from your diaspora.
Which, if you're living in a new country, that community is literally your entire support system. You'd lose everything.
Exactly. It's a very powerful, invisible coercion.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, though. We always assume that in the digital age, cash is just dead. Nobody uses cash. But from these sources, it sounds like cash is actually their strongest operational weapon.
Oh, it absolutely is. Cash severs the electronic link completely.
So it just creates fragmented visibility across different banks, like 100 people withdrawing $50 looks like nothing.
Exactly. Small amounts get combined in physical spaces before moving via couriers or intermediaries. The banks are blind to the consolidation.
Which is why the investigators in the Marseille case couldn't just use bank records. They had to rely on intercepted communications, witness testimony, and like physical local spreadsheets to expose the structure.
Yeah, they had to go old school. And that leads to where this cash is actually being managed. The community and cultural associations.
Places that are supposed to be safe havens.
Right. And these places perform vital, completely legitimate functions, language classes, migrant support, cultural events.
But their trusted positions get totally exploited.
Yeah. They get used for private meetings, coordination, and actual record keeping of these cash collections. The legitimate facade hides the illicit activity.
So as an investigator, how do you spot that?
You look at governance. Risk really increases when these associations have poor cash documentation or unexplained intermediaries.
Or when senior members use their personal accounts for association money.
Exactly. That's a huge red flag.
So this brings up a huge question. Why do the incredibly expensive algorithms built by these massive financial institutions keep missing this?
Well, simply put, they are looking for the wrong crime.
Right, because they're looking for money laundering.
Yeah, money laundering is all about concealing the source of dirty money.
Illegal money.
But terrorist financing, especially here, often uses clean, legally earned money.
Legitimate salaries, honest business profits, regular donations.
So it's like a river. Money laundering takes toxic, polluted water and tries to filter it clean. But terrorist financing takes perfectly clean drinking water and poisons it at the very end of the line.
That is a perfect way to describe it. No wonder the banks are looking in the wrong place. They're looking for the water filters, not the poison.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this fundamental distinction shifts the entire detection problem for investigators. It's incredibly hard to catch clean money moving legally.
But French criminal law doesn't even require an actual terrorist attack to take place to prosecute this, right?
Correct. Just the gathering of the funds with the intent to support the group is enough.
Though the extortion part, the campagne, does actually add a bit of a money laundering element, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Because once you use coercion to get those funds, that perfectly clean money legally becomes criminal property.
Wow, that is a wild legal knot to untangle. Which brings us to the political side of this, because you might be listening and thinking, well, can't we just wait for the geopolitical conflict to end?
If only it were that simple. The timeline the sources give for 2025 and 2026 really shows why the legal reality is much more complicated.
Yeah, let's look at that. And just to be clear, we are impartially reporting the facts from the sources here. So in May 2025, PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan actually called for the group to dissolve its organizational structure and end its armed struggle.
A huge geopolitical moment.
But by 2026, the peace process was seriously strained. Disarmament and legal guarantees remained heavily contested.
And crucially, the PKK was still under EU terrorism-related designation frameworks.
So what does this all mean for the banks? If a group makes a public declaration that they are dissolving, can the compliance teams just, like, flip a switch and stop monitoring?
Absolutely not. They can't do that at all.
Really? How do financial crime teams handle that kind of whiplash?
Well, a public declaration from a leader doesn't magically prove that the connected underground networks have ceased operating.
Oh, right. The money might still be moving.
Exactly. Financial institutions must follow current laws and restrictive measures frameworks. They rely on evidence-based assessments from regulators, not public political announcements.
That makes sense. The law is the law until the government officially changes it.
Yeah, and historical financial conduct remains fully prosecutable under the laws that applied when it occurred. You don't just get a free pass for extortion you did 3 years ago because of a new peace treaty.
So if we can't rely on political declarations and standard algorithms are useless, how do investigators actually stop this without, you know, ruining innocent lives?
The sources outline something called a resilient control stack.
A resilient control stack. What does that actually look like?
It involves really risk-sensitive customer understanding, deep governance analysis of those associations, and network monitoring.
So looking at the web of connections, not just a single transaction.
Right. And then using intelligence-led escalation. But here is the most important part, the absolute necessity of avoiding profiling.
Yeah, because political activism or just attending demonstrations for Kurdish rights does not establish PKK financing.
Not at all. And a system that indiscriminately targets lawful diaspora activity is honestly just as defective as one that misses the coercive fundraising.
It seems incredibly delicate, though. If I'm an investigator, how do I tell the difference between a passionate community organizer and a prohibited fundraiser? How do you avoid accidentally criminalizing an entire diaspora's lawful civic activity?
It has to be grounded purely in behavior, confirmed relationships, and financial purpose. Never ethnicity.
Which brings up this concept in the sources called protected customer engagement. I found this part so interesting.
Oh, it's vital because you have to remember the person making the contribution might actually be a victim.
Right. The restaurant owner paying the tax out of fear.
Yes. So banks need protocols where that victim has a safe, protected way to disclose the community pressure they are under without putting themselves in more danger.
Wow. That completely changes how you view the person at the teller window.
It really does. It's a very human problem, not just a data problem.
So to wrap this up, the sources really reveal the weaponization of community trust. It's incredible to see the crucial difference between hiding dirty money and weaponizing clean money.
Yeah, the distinction is everything.
And just the immense, almost impossible challenge of policing global finance through local neighborhoods. I hope this deep dive gives you listening a new lens to view the world.
Definitely.
Because when you hear about global conflicts or financial regulations now, you understand the invisible human-level networks operating just beneath the surface of everyday commerce.
And I want to leave you with a final thought here. The sources detailed how physical community centers and local associations were hijacked for coercive fundraising.
Right.
So think about your own life, especially your digital communities, the forums or groups you belong to. If a bad actor wanted to apply silent social pressure to extract resources from you without any physical threats, what trusted structure, physical or virtual, would they exploit first?
Man, that is a heavy question to end on, but so important. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.